Here's our friend Rich Lenkoff. He is a Capital member at Downey & Lenkoff and the co-host of the Legal Face-Off podcast, which you can find at WGNradio.com and everywhere. Hey, Rich, welcome back.
Good to be on again, John.
January 6th, I've been borrowing some bad publicity here. I'm surprised that, and I don't know that I agree with the idea, that if you were not only convicted of a crime relative to the insurrection, but even if you were accused of being an insurrectionist, the city and state have said, you cannot work for us. Is that legal?
It's legal. There are a couple of things at play here, but the bottom line is it's legal. The applicants could allege and probably will allege that a couple of laws are violated if they are prevented from holding city jobs because of their accusation or their conviction. There's something called the Employee Background Fairness Act that prohibits employers from disqualifying job applicants based on a criminal conviction record, but it doesn't apply to convictions that are a direct result of illegal activities, so that probably won't fly. The other one that applies in these situations is the Illinois Human Rights Act that prevents discipline because of a conviction record. But, you know, not only has City of Chicago done this, but Pritzker signed a law statewide. So they can, despite those two laws I quoted, they can be barred from city work because of the nexus between that and what they would be doing for the city.
And is the foundation of that you were convicted of a crime? I mean, is that really the sort of strength of that? Because I could say, but that doesn't seem to wash. Suppose I had a speeding ticket. Suppose I was an armed robber and I'm out and I've changed my life. I don't know. Pick the crime. But is the city saying that anybody who has committed any crime can never work for the city? Or are they only saying this crime? And that's what bothers me, because now it seems politically motivated. And I'm tired of the political motivations and tic-tackiness. Rich?
Sure. No, I think the any crime would certainly violate the two laws that I mentioned. But in this case, I think the exception is, and the logic is, that the nature of these convictions was related to government work, right? If you are convicted of trying to overthrow an election and charge the Senate, then working for a government should be prohibited. That's the logic. So there's some nexus between what was found in that case and their work versus just, you know, a speeding ticket or something else.
Yeah, I get that. I get that. I mean, you're not the first person to point that out to me, and it wasn't apparent to me when I first started making this argument. If the crime is you were trying to overthrow a government, then maybe governments shouldn't hire you. If you are convicted of, I don't know, some sort of numbers violation, maybe you shouldn't be hired by an accounting firm. I see the nexus there. But this even
remember that these people were pardoned, right, and their sentences were commuted. So how do you deal with that? How do you still hold, you know, prevent them from holding jobs when technically they were pardoned?
Yeah, well,
that's an interesting question.
What does that mean? Technically they were pardoned. Does that mean in the law it never happened, or just that it happened and now you have full rights, in other words?
Commutation means that their criminal sentence is reduced without excusing the underlying conviction, while a pardon completely forgives the crime and restores the person's right. So commuting still means that they were guilty of a crime, but the pardon means that they were no longer considered guilty. So for sure, you know, if I was someone who was pardoned, I would argue that you can't prevent me from holding a job because I was never guilty of a crime. Commutation is a little different, but, you know, I would argue if I was them or their lawyer, and inevitably there'll be lawsuits. Now listen, the chief executive of this country felt that I shouldn't be punished. How could you, you know, a mere city council, prevent me from holding a job?
Wait a minute, Donald. I thought you were going to reference the fact that the president of the United States has been convicted of crimes and charged with crimes. And isn't it ironic
that
very administration is the okay. Well, but this is also people who are accused of crimes. months after President Donald Trump pardoned more than 1,500 defendants accused or convicted in connection to the January 6th attack. People that are defendants accused or convicted. So I don't know what accused means there. I wonder how you would determine that person who's ineligible to work for the city or state.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it would be more difficult to win a lawsuit from someone who is merely accused but not convicted. Again, for the same logic, I mean, you need a conviction, I believe, under, you know, all of the laws that we're discussing to enforce this. So I agree that someone who has been denied a city job merely as a result of an accusation, especially when you're considering how aggressive the DOJ was in prosecuting these cases. It's not like they didn't go after these people. They did, and they successfully convicted many of them. So I would argue, if I was their attorney, that listen, accusations don't mean anything unless there's some conviction.
Talking to Rich Lenkoff, the attorney, who said, I'll give you a couple more minutes of my time. I don't know what your billable rate is, but I appreciate you giving us a little extra time here, Rich.
The bill is in the mail, as always, coming to you as we speak.
I hope not. Do you all know what each other charges? Like, so you're an attorney in town. There's hundreds and hundreds of you, thousands, I suppose. Is there kind of a standard rate? Everybody kind of knows what it is, and then some people are above and below?
Good question. Yeah, I mean, in your particular practice area, usually the rates are pretty consistent, right? Just because, just like you can't go to one grocery store and pay, you know, $12 for milk and the other, you know, you got to pay what the market bears. Same thing in the legal field. We're all sort of within the same neighborhood, and when one firm changes their rates, everyone else follows suit. That being said, I have a question for you. Guess what the highest hourly rate is currently in the country? Can you guess?
For an attorney?
In New York, I'll give you a hint. For an attorney, per hour of their time?
$1,000 an hour.
That's a pretty good guess, because that was forever the sort of, you know, threshold that blew everyone's mind once firms were charging $1,000. That was only a couple years ago. They are currently three times that. There are firms in New York for certain types of work charging $3,000 per hour.
I wonder what that would be.
Good work if you can get it.
Damage control or politics? Whose expertise is so extraordinary and clients so wealthy that they could get $3,000 an hour?
Well, the big firms, big law. I mean, you've heard now in the news the last month about Trump going after big law firms. Those law firms have, you know, at the upper ends of the scale for attorneys who are very experienced, and particularly in transactions and mergers and acquisitions, you know, when you're considering that some of these acquisitions deal right with billions of dollars of assets, you're going to spend lots of money in legal, and those attorneys know that, and they're charging at the higher end of that market. Not getting those rates quite yet, but I hope to one day.
Not yet. And as Harvard is finally saying, okay, we're drawing the line, some law firms are now saying we're not going to cooperate with the administration demands. Is that right?
Absolutely. There's a handful of firms that are fighting back that have literally filed lawsuits. Same thing with universities who are fighting back against what Trump is doing. And there's good legal basis to do so. I mean, basically, Trump is, you know, on a retribution tour with these law firms, and it violates due process. It violates First Amendment. Among those are the two things that come to mind first as a law firm. You know, you have rights just like anyone else. And for Trump to basically, you know, threaten you unless you comply is crazy and violates the Constitution.
There was an op-ed or a letter to the editor. I think it was an op-ed in the Tribune this week. You may have seen it from an attorney in town. And he was talking about the capitulation by these big law firms. And I think the thrust of his argument, I'm trying to recall what his point was. I thought it was interesting, though, is that they make so much money that it corrupts their vision of what's right. I think that was it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I saw that. I mean, it's absolutely disgusting and shameful that law firms are accepting what is a shakedown, which is at the end of the day, it's just a simple shakedown and agreeing to millions and millions of dollars. I think the total right now is $1 billion of pledged pro bono work for causes that Trump favors. It doesn't matter what you know, the pro bono work involves. You can, as a government official, as the highest ranking government official, go into a private company like a law firm and demand that they work for you for free if they, in exchange for not prosecuting them. I mean, that's crazy. That's tyranny. You remember the quote, everyone always quotes, you know, first they come after the lawyers, let's kill all the lawyers. People quote that as a idea that, you know, lawyers are bad. That's from Shakespeare, and that's from a play where the idea was taking over the government. And the reason that you want to kill the lawyers first is because that's the first line of defense, right? When you the first line of defense against tyranny is let's get rid of the lawyers. Same thing is happening here. When you go after the lawyers and these law firms are capitulating on what Trump wants, my friends, that's the beginning of the end from my perspective in many ways.
So yesterday there was a shooting at Florida State, and News Nation had a detailed story about the idea that maybe the mother of the shooter might be held somewhat liable. She's a sheriff's deputy, but it was her gun. What's the current status about holding the parents responsible for the shootings that their kids do?
Well, in the wake of the seminal case on this, 2021, the Crumbleys in the Oxford High School, Michigan case, that was really the first, those were the first parents in the United States to be convicted in connection with a mass school shooting. They were sentenced to at least 10 years in prison for involuntary manslaughter last year. So the trend now, as you know, as you've seen and covered, is to not only hold the shooter responsible, but to hold the guardians, the parents responsible as well, particularly where, as in the Florida State case, they, you know, the shooting was involving their weaponry. We saw that here in Highland Park with Robert Cremo, who faced charges. He ultimately pled out, but he was the father to the Highland Park shooting, and he also was, he was prosecuted criminally. So there's definitely
and he went to jail. And he went to jail.
Went to jail only for 60 days, 2 years of probation, but he did go to jail.
You think that it should have been longer?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, he was charged with, I think, 7 counts of reckless conduct. Remember, he sponsored, at the time, his kid was 19 years old. He sponsored his application for a FOID card, even though he knew there were prior incidents involving threats of violence and mental health issues. So, yeah, I think 60 days was light for that, for sure.
I wonder if down the road...
Remember, there's also civil liability. Yeah, this is criminal liability we're talking about. There's always been civil liability. I mean, parents are, you know, sued all the time for civil liability.
Is that happening in the Cremo case, too, do you know?
Absolutely. Yep. They're suing them. But, I mean, the deeper pockets is always someone else, right? I mean, going after the father is not going to yield many damages. The deeper pockets are, in that case, they're going after the gun manufacturer who produced the gun that he used. Going after a corporation is more lucrative.
A judge did say that they could pursue that, right? That hasn't been summarily thrown out.
Correct. I mean, those cases don't get thrown out initially. There's enough for that, you know, issue to at least go to a jury. Whether they'll be successful or not is a different question. But you're right that the judge ruled that initially there's enough to proceed.
I could predict how that would end if it got to the Supreme Court.
What do you think?
This Supreme Court? I think they would hold
this one,
for the
this
gun
particular
manufacturer.
One, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But then in the case of this shooting at Florida State, it was a 20-year-old man, not a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old. It was a sheriff's deputy's gun. I guess that's really all we know right now. Any other insight about a case like that?
Well, I know that there was this custody battle, and the mother was, you know, the mother allegedly kidnapped the kid to Norway. I mean, whether that relates to, you know, ultimately what happened, who knows? But, you know, the key question from what you're asking is whether the mother, who was a, 18-year veteran of the police force, whether she was negligent in allowing her child to access her guns. And that'll just come down to what she was doing to protect her guns at home. Presumably, as a police officer, she had lots of guns, right? And if she wasn't making sure that even a 20-year-old didn't have access to them, then there's certainly liability there.
In the case of the Highland Park shooter, and maybe this too, maybe that kind of a pursuit, that kind of a prosecution or conviction is sufficiently novel right now that we're going light on the sentences. It's like, well, it's not like we all knew this was the way it was going to be. This is brand new law or interpretation of law. So I wonder if going forward the sentences will be more severe, and the sort of caution that that will throw to gun owners will, you know, they'll, I want to use the word heed, they'll heed the law or the advice of people who say, make sure that you safeguard your gun. I wonder if ultimately that will have that impact, you know?
I think you're right, and I think it's a very smart point to say that the sentence is probably lighter because this is relatively novel case law, and there isn't a lot of precedent, right? I mean, judges rely on precedent, and they rely on sentencing guidelines. You can't have that if there's never been a conviction. I think that's a strong point. The other point is Cremo versus the Crumbleys in Michigan, he pled out, right? So obviously you're going to get a better deal if you plead out and save the prosecution the time and resources of pursuing it. In the Michigan case in Oxford High School, they went to trial and they asserted that they were not responsible, and a jury disagreed and, you know, found them both to be at least or gave them at least 10 years in prison. So that will send a strong message, I think, for sure. 10 years is no joke, obviously.
It's going to be weird, though. I mean, a couple of my listeners had said, okay, we have shootings every day in Chicago. What about all of these kids that are shooting up, you know, teen takeovers or gang violence? Shall we go after the parents of all of those kids on the South and West Side? I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's an interesting question, Rich.
Definitely. I mean, once you find parents liable for one thing, it seems obvious, perhaps, in a school shooting involving a gun that was owned by a parent. That seems like an obvious nexus. I think your caller or listener raises a great question. What if the teen takeover resulted in a death? Are you then holding the parent responsible? That's a bit of a harder question. There's not a strong nexus there. What did the parent do? They didn't give access to a weapon. They merely did not keep their kid home. I mean, that might not be enough for things like negligent homicide and voluntary manslaughter. What if you give your kids a car and they get drunk and they plow into someone? Is that enough? I mean, those have been held also to be guilty. But yes, once you start with the idea that other people can be responsible for the acts of a child, then there's lots of other theories of liability.
And I know there's some parents out there who own guns and they've done everything they can to safeguard them, and the kid somehow gets a hold of it and bad things happen or will happen, and it'll be hard now to put that person in jail, but maybe we're going to have to do that. I think we need to think about this as we go forward. I'm out of time with you today, Rich, but just give me the headline on this DePaul student, and the next time we talk, maybe we'll pick it up there. But what's your interest in that case?
Two things. Number one, it took 5 months for them to arrest the individual and charge him criminally. That's finally been done.
Give us the story. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, two Jewish students were protesting at DePaul here in Lincoln Park in Chicago, and they were attacked on video by a couple of masked individuals, presumably who were adverse to, you know, their pro-Israel stance, and they were beaten up. And just yesterday it was announced that at least one of the two individuals was charged and arrested. He's been identified. I think he was in court today. That's the criminal part. And, you know, many are wondering why it took so long to find them, especially considering the attack was caught on video, but they were masked. The civil part is these two individuals are suing DePaul University for negligence, basically, for failing to adequately protect them when they had notice of these kind of protests. Obviously, we all saw the protests in November of last year, and failed to remedy them. According to one of the individuals involved, there was a security guard right nearby and failed to do anything. So I think, you know, maybe the more interesting and possibly bigger story is whether DePaul faces civil liability. And to your earlier point, in the wake of what's going on now with Trump going after these universities, I think the climate to hold them responsible is better, in, for lack of a better term, now than it was a few months ago.
Yeah, I see your point. Rich Lankoff, Capital member Downey & Lankoff, co-host of our Legal Face-Off podcast. You can find that at WGNradio.com, and his podcast is everywhere. Hey, Rich, thanks for your help today.
Thank you, King.